Good morning. Good morning. Two Mormons visited yesterday. I had a very nice chat with two of them. You may have noticed my friend Wayne, who's usually here in this second row, this young guy, who's 19 and third year in college. And Wayne is a remarkable guy. He's lived with me on and off for several years. He got a job as a security guard so he could read, because he doesn't have to make his rounds very often. So he's reading philosophy and Dostoevsky and Kierkegaard and just devours this stuff. Well, the Mormons have found this out, so they have been going over every night to his job and talking to him 2-3 hours on the and then they have to call in and report that they're staying past their curfew, which is 10:30. But a couple of these guys are so, I think, tuned into to Jesus right now. I just can't imagine them staying in the Mormon church. And just the way they don't talk about the Book of Mormon and want to know about God in the Bible and want to know about the evangelical view of things. I'm really excited. The group that's called Ex-Mormons for Jesus, which consists of people who've left the Mormon church, say on their website that 50% of Mormon missionaries leave the Mormon church at the end of their 2 years of missionary duty, and they leave because of contacts with evangelicals. Well, that's just interesting. So there is a much more of a harvest than you might imagine with these young kids. Does it go for? I don't know how to nuke a Jehovah's Witness or anything. We're in Jericho. Last week, we went with Jesus to Jericho. He's on his way to Jerusalem. And we had those two marvelous events of Jesus running onto two blind men by the side of the road and healing at least one of them, restoring his sight to Bartimaeus. And then going a little further down the road and coming to in this crowded part of town with a big sycamore fig tree and this little short guy up in the tree named Zacchaeus, who was the district tax collector, extremely rich and extremely corrupt, and nobody would like that. Nobody likes IRS, nobody likes tax collectors. As long as they paid the Romans their share, they could rip off the public, and they did. And Zacchaeus wanted to be noticed, but Jesus noticed him and said, "Hey, by the way, Zacchaeus, come down. I'm going to stay at your house tonight." So we have enjoyed the hospitality of Zacchaeus, who immediately wanted to know the Lord, and that's signified by the fact that he wanted to give half of his wealth away to the poor immediately, and he wanted to take the other half of his wealth and repay the people he defrauded them fourfold. So there's no question about Zacchaeus getting pretty radically changed by the Lord in a very short time. And then after a good night's rest, Jesus gets on the trail with his disciples to head up to Jerusalem. Jericho is down below sea level. It's warm and tropical. It has a huge spring still there to this day, 1 million gallons an hour or some huge amount that just keeps the whole area lush and green. And then there is the little road that winds up to Jerusalem about 18 miles. You can go the modern highway if you want, or you can go the old road, which is scary and full of twists and turns. And if you fall down, you'll fall into the Wadi Getty, that is a sheer drop-off. Well, now, we have for quite a few weeks in cruising through Luke, we've been dealing with material that is only in Luke, and it's not in the other Gospels, there's not very much of it in the other Gospels. And now that we're coming to the final week in the life of Jesus, it's time to run to your old harmony of the Gospels. I think we passed a short version out. It's a great book to have as a handy reference because the Gospels are printed in parallel in columns in the supposed order of the actual events taking place. And, of course, every harmony will have minor disagreements because you can't always be 100% sure, but there's a huge guide. And now we're coming to places in Luke where some of the things that are not in Luke at all are fairly important. So I'd like to do, first of all this morning, a flashback. A flashback of a earlier visit of Jesus up to Jerusalem, maybe a week or 2 weeks earlier. Jesus had been in Jerusalem at wintertime at Hanukkah and found considerable hostility from the crowd, and he had to kind of get out of town. At Hanukkah, that's December. Passover is March, April, so he's biding his time until the Passover when he comes to his final visit in Jerusalem. But in John 11, let's quick do a little excursus over into John 11 and 12. It sort of fits in here. Jesus is down around Jericho, or he's down around the valley, someplace down there, teaching to the crowds, and this incident happens, for which he takes a real quick zip trip up to Jerusalem and back. Dangerous trip, because the hostility in Jerusalem is so severe that any sighting of him is going to immediately get the feds after him and the police and attempts on his life. So it's dangerous for him to go to Jerusalem. But, of course, he's going to go during the last week. But let's quick look at chapter 11 of John. A certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and Martha. We met them before in Luke. We were introduced to them. The parents are apparently dead, and these two sisters and brother live together in Bethany, which is on the very near the top of the Mount of Olives, just over the eastern part. You can go there and you can see the tomb of Lazarus. It's right near another little town called Bethpage. It's right there. It was that same Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sisters sent to Jesus, saying, "Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick." So the sisters dispatch a messenger from Jerusalem, say, down to maybe Jericho, with the news that Lazarus is very seriously ill. When Jesus heard that, he said, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it." Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So these are dear friends of Jesus, and he stays in their home whenever he has the opportunity to do so. But when he finds out Lazarus is sick, he remains right where he is for 2 days, which is rather strange. After this, he said to his disciples, "Let's go to Judea again. Now let's go on up to Jerusalem." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and are you going there again?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. If anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." These things he said, and after that he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him." His disciples said, "Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get well." However, Jesus spoke of his death. But they thought he was speaking about Lazarus taking rest in sleep. And Jesus said plainly, "Lazarus is dead." Jesus is assuring them that if he's got useful work to do, he'll have God's protection. And so he's not particularly worried about the dangerous journey up and back. "I am glad for your sakes that I was not there when Lazarus died, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let's go up to him." Take an all-day journey, 17, 18 miles uphill. Quite a little time has elapsed since Lazarus became ill. Thomas, who's called Didymus, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go that we may die with him." There's this super rational, logical Thomas who says, it's very fatalistic. If Jesus goes up to Jerusalem, he's going to get killed for sure. Let's go and die with him. Just that's kind of Thomas. So they all head up to Jerusalem. And when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away. Many of the Jews had joined the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary was sitting in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." It wouldn't have been possible for Jesus to get there in time, as it turns out. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live, and whoever lives and believes in me shall never die." Do you believe this? There's that wonderful verse that we often like to bring to mind. She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world." When she had said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary, her sister, saying, "The teacher has come and is calling for you." As soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came to him. Jesus had not yet come into the town, but was in the place where Martha met him. Martha had gone out ahead to meet him. The Jews who were with her in the house and comforting her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, saying, "She is going to the tomb to weep there." Then when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. Deeply moved in spirit. The Greek says that he snorted like a horse. Now, that doesn't mean anything in English. It's the idea of his deep emotional distress that he felt when he came to the realization that his friend Lazarus had died. He said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Shortest verse in the Bible. The Jews said, "See how he loved him." Some of them said, "Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?" Then Jesus, again groaning in himself, feeling the anguish and agony and pain of death, identifying with all of us in that and experience of death, he came to the tomb, and it was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, "Lord, by this time there is a stench. He's been dead 4 days. No embalming, hot climate, corpse not in good condition." Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?" They took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And I know that you always hear me, but because of people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me." And when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And he who had died came out, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Loose him and let him go." So that's rather beautiful. Somebody has commented that it's a good thing that he put the name Lazarus here. And if he had said, "Come forth," he would have emptied all the cemeteries in the area. But he said Lazarus only. I think that's a Stedman remark. Now, this is a pretty remarkable thing that Lazarus should be resuscitated, restored to life, and restored to good health. Now, he's going to go on, live out the rest of his life, and die. So this is not a resurrection into a new body. It's more of a restoration of his old life. And it's a very interesting picture that when you're raised from the dead, you have to throw off your old grave clothes. We all have to do that. Let the grave clothes fall away and be the new men and women that we are. Many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him. Now we're going to get friends of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus who live up in Bethany and Bethpage, who are sort of out of downtown Jerusalem, and they're up in the in the hillside, and this collective group of people is going to be much more open to the gospel. And so we begin to get a circle of converts from the resurrection of Lazarus. Many of the Jews who had come to Jesus and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the thing Jesus did. The chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What shall we do? This man works many signs." So the news leaks down to the Pharisees. They get together and have a strategy meeting. We better get this Jesus right now. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. One of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish." This he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. So in spite of himself, Caiaphas uttered an accurate prophecy. From that day on, they plotted to put him to death, and Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there into the country near the wilderness to a city called Ephraim, and there remained with his disciples. He can't stay around Jerusalem anymore. He gets out of town. Now, the months go by, couple weeks go by, the Passover of the Jews was near, and many from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover went to purify themselves. And they sought Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple, "What do you think, that he will not come to the feast?" Both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was, he should report it and they should seize him. Now that's background. Now Jesus leaves. So we see this little quick 2-day trip up to Jerusalem for the raising of Lazarus. We see a little flurry of converts around the home of Mary and Martha and this little group of enthusiastic people. And it's a quick dash into town, and then Jesus goes out of town again up to Samaria and back down to Jericho, where he can minister without being in constant fear of his life. All right? So that's a flashback. There's probably one more flashback that's fun that happens on the road to Jerusalem that's not recorded in Luke, and that it's found in Mark 20. We'll look at that. Let's look at that real quick, and then we'll get back on the road. Mark 20:20. Matthew 20:20. Pardon me. It's in Mark 10. So, this is an interesting little bit. It's a little glimpse into the politics going on. Now, if this is Jesus' last trip up to Jerusalem, he's going to bring in the kingdom. We're going to have a great day up there, and then Jesus is going to lay out this big, wonderful kingdom, and we're all going to get choice places. Matthew 20, let's start at 17. Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples aside on the road and said to them, "Behold, we're going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and to the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify, and the third day he will rise again." He's already said that once before, and they didn't believe it, didn't get it, didn't understand it, still don't. And now we have a mother, an interested mother, shows up here. The mother of Zebedee, James and John, sons of Zebedee, the mother of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. He said to her, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one at your right hand and one at the left, in your kingdom." Sound like a concerned mother looking after the best interest.
You didn't hear what the 12 disturbed,
Yeah. She didn't get that part, no. Jesus answered and said, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and to be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with?" James and John said, "We are able." That's a little naive. Little do they realize what that means. "You will indeed," Jesus said, "drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared by my Father." When the 10 other disciples heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brothers. "How dare you push yourselves up at the head of the line like this?" And all of us are deserving. So there's all this squabble, rivalry among the disciples at this point. And here's where one of the most important sayings of Jesus comes in. Jesus called to them to himself, and he said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them, yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant, and whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Turns everything upside down. If you want to be great in the kingdom of God, be the best possible servant. Go to the lowest place at the dinner table. Be content to be the slave of others. And that's great. And Jesus is the example of that. We often emphasize that here at PVC in our non-hierarchical church structure. Most churches are top-down, hierarchical, and not PVC, and that's because this principle has been so important over the years here. So that's a little bit of an incident. It gives you a little clue. The disciples are squabbling and full of rivalry, and those are little flashbacks. Now let's go back to chapter 19 of Luke, and verse 11. That's where we stopped last week. As they heard these things, he spoke another parable because he was near Jerusalem and because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately. There's this anticipation that magically Jesus will bring in the kingdom now that he's on the way to Jerusalem. Jesus said, tells them a story. "A certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called 10 of his servants, delivered to them 10 minas, and he said to them, 'Do business until I come.'" A mina is about 100 denarii. And a denarius, remember, is a day's wage. So he gives, one mina, or mina, is a 3 months of wages. Is that right? And so he takes his servants and he hands them a very large sum of money, the same sum of money to each one of them. "I'm going off to a foreign country and be appointed king. I'm only a nobleman now, and when I come back, I'll take charge of the affairs of my kingdom. Do business until I come." Verse 14, "But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, 'We will not have this man to reign over us.' And so it was that when he returned, having received the kingdom, he then commanded these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. Then came the first, saying, 'Master, your mina has earned 10 minas.' And he said to him, 'Well done, good servant, because you were faithful in a very little, have authority over 10 cities.' The second came, saying, 'Master, your mina has earned 5 minas.' Likewise, he said to him, 'You shall be over 5 cities.' Another came, saying, 'Master, here is your mina, which I have put away in a handkerchief. I feared that you, because you are an austere man, you collect what you do not deposit and reap what you do not sow. the nobleman said to him, out of your mouth, I will judge you, you wicked servant. You knew that I was an austere man, collecting what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in the bank, that at my coming I might have collected it with interest? He said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to the one who has 10. They said to him, Master, he already has 10. I say to you that everyone who has more will be given from him who does not have. Even what he has will be taken away from him. And bring here those enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them and slay them before me. So that's really interesting. Now, this will remind you immediately of the parable of the talents, which is not the same story. That's the parable of talents comes a little bit later in the week. So we need to pick out the symbolism here. Now, there's the hearers of this story would have immediately thought of an event in fairly recent Jewish history that reminded them of this story. Anybody know what that is? Professor Aniker would, I'm sure, recall this. Herod the Great died, and his son Archelaus inherited the kingdom, the territory that King Herod had previously had jurisdiction over. But Archelaus was a really bad guy, and he also was ambitious. So he wanted also to be king, and he went off to Rome and took a delegation of his friends and family and supporters to make a case before the king that he should be made before Caesar, that he should be made the king, given the title of king. And a bunch of the Jews who knew how cruel and despotic he was went afterwards, went to Rome also, and made a very convincing case about how cruel and brutal he was. And Caesar says, well, I'm not going to make you king now, but I'll let you keep your present office and let's see how it goes. So that was an incident that had actually happened some years ago that most of these people would have remembered. Now, what's the story really about? What's this story? Why this story? Well, who is the nobleman? Well, the nobleman is Jesus, right? And he's going to go leave them for a while, and while he's gone, he's going to crowned a legitimate king over the territory, and then he's going to come back. In the meantime, he takes his 10 choice servants and he gives them an equal sum of money and asks them to make good use of it. In the parable of talents, it's a variable sum of money. Now, what is the 10 minas stand for? What is that? Stands for something. What is it that everybody gets equally, no matter who you are, you're old or young or smart or not too smart or rich or poor, you get this something, and then you have to use it until the king comes back. How do you use your salvation? Yes, okay, so let's say that the sum of money is like the gospel. It's like something that's entrusted to you. Your gift of salvation and eternal life from Jesus is like a deposit that you can't just keep for yourself. You're supposed to invest your life and your time and energy and resources in multiplying and spreading and advancing the kingdom. Have the opportunity to do that every day. Some people do more, some people do less. That makes sense? And the reward is going to be authority over cities. Talking to Jews here. He's talking to a Jewish audience. And that's a little hint about being faithful in small things means that God will entrust you with big, hard assignments. Imagine one of you in here being in charge of 10 of these cities up and down the peninsula all at once, being the mayor. The mayor. Yes, that San Jose needs a mayor right now. All right, so does that all make sense? You and I have been given a deposit which is salvation, which is the gospel. We understand the content of the gospel. We have the rest of our lives to spread that influence, to let God use us, to multiply the influence of the kingdom until the king comes back. And when the king comes back, he'll assess our performance and reward us accordingly with higher responsibility. What about this one guy? The one guy who didn't do nothing. He lost his one. He lost his. Did he lose his salvation? Do you think? Maybe not. Maybe not. But he didn't have any. He's maybe one of those people that has nothing to show for his whole Christian life. That's exactly right. That's a clue. He's acting according to what he believes Jesus is like: austere, cautious, conservative businessman. So he's acting on what his presuppositions are about Jesus, but he gets it wrong. So that's in there, isn't it? Well, I don't think the minute is salvation exactly. It's more like the what did you get? What kind of a deposit did Jesus leave with you when you came to know him? What did he give to you that you can use? The gospel, the Spirit, and the gospel, and unlimited opportunities to share that. Yes, that would be good, wouldn't it? Hiding your light under the bushel. Well, I don't know. I don't think we want to be in the position of this one guy who got his master figured out wrong. Use it or lose it. Now, there's a lot of hostility in and around this kingdom because there's a lot of people that don't want this nobleman to be king over them. And what does the king do with them? He comes right in and slays them in front of his eyes, has them killed. How does that sound like gentle Jesus, meek and mild? It doesn't sound like that. Jesus is always going to be totally mild with his enemies. Yeah, that would be, I think that would probably get to the example of people that have an ultra-conservative view of God's, the righteousness that the law requires, and trapped in some kind of a legal, and has never bothered to get to know the master very well. It's kind of a strange story, isn't it? How do you validate? How do we validate this in real life? I mean, how do we check up on ourselves and how are we doing? That's a good question. How do you know if you are making good use of the gospel that's been deposited with you? Mm-hmm. So trustworthy, that's an important clue. I think that's going to come into account here. What kind of a relationship do you have with God? How well do you know him? Do you know how God acts in history? How does Jesus act? How does Jesus treat people? We don't want to turn this into salvation or brownie points by works and things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's read on. Obvious risk-taking. When you've got somebody else's resources entrusted to you, and you have to, in order to invest, you've got to risk. As you would in the stock market or in a business venture, you could lose. You've got to... that calls for faith, doesn't it? Yeah. Okay, we're traveling up the road to Jerusalem. Let's do a little bit more. And a long, hot day in the sunshine and not much water. There's the inn of the Good Samaritans still there, if you go there. I suppose you could stop for water, but anyway. When he had said all this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. And it came to pass, when he came near to Bethpage and Bethany, at the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples. He's going to stay with Mary and Martha and Lazarus in their home. And now he sends ahead, saying, go into the village opposite you, where as you enter you will find a colt tied on which no one has ever sat. Loose him and bring him to me. It's going to be a mother donkey and her foal. Jesus has probably on his previous trip done some arranging. He's arranged the place for the Last Supper. He's probably made some negotiations that with Hertz ran a donkey for the use of this donkey. So it's probably something that he set up. And he gets his disciples to go get these donkeys. If anyone asks you, why are you loosing him? Thus you shall say to him, because the Lord has need of him. So those who were sent departed and found it just as he said to them. As they were loosing the colt, the owners of it said to them, why are you loosing the colt? And they said, the Lord has need of it. Just alone. And they brought him to Jesus. And they threw their garments on the colt, and they set Jesus on him. So they bring the mother donkey and her foal. The foal's going to be much safer, feel much safer with his mother there. And they put a blanket on the young donkey for Jesus to sit on. I don't know if you've ever ridden on a small donkey before. Little tiny. They're very sturdy animals. I remember riding out to the tomb of King Akhenaten in Egypt on a donkey once in the hot sun. And this sturdy little animal in the rough desert, and you have to fold your legs to keep your feet from dragging on the ground. They're just little creatures, but they're sturdy and they're fun. They're much more fun than, in a way, than camels, which are way, way high up off the ground. They rock and sway, but donkeys are neat. Now, is there anything special about donkeys in the Middle East at this time? Kings. Kings traditionally rode on donkeys, or very rich people, or royalty. So the donkeys were not just for ordinary people to ride on. They were beasts of burden. You could use them as pack donkeys. And horses had been introduced, but what about horses? Well, they're from Egypt, and they're associated more with warfare. All right? And there's a reason why Jesus has deliberately selected a donkey. Verse 36, as they went on along the road, the people from the villages of Bethany and Bethpage, come out and spread their clothes on the road out in front of Jesus. And obviously there's a great deal of enthusiasm generated that Jesus is coming into Jerusalem riding on the foal of a donkey. Then as he was drawing near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had seen, saying, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. A quote from a couple of the Hallel Psalms of praise. Some of the Pharisees called him from the crowd, teacher, rebuke your disciples. And he answered and said to them, I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would immediately cry out. As he drew near, he saw the city and wept over it. This is the so-called triumphal entry. And we also think of this as Palm Sunday because they had palm branches. So they don't have palms in very many in Jerusalem now, but they probably did back then. And you'll notice that there's an enthusiastic band of supporters around Jesus. This enthusiastic band of supporters are these friends of Mary and Martha and Lazarus and the converts in Bethany and Bethpage. And they're excited because Jesus is coming into town as the legitimate king of Israel, and he's riding on a colt, and he's doing this in exact fulfillment of a prophecy of Zechariah. Why is this not really a triumphal entry? With all this enthusiasm and all this praising, because the rest of the city is totally hostile and ready to put him to death, and he's already been rejected. So it really shouldn't be called the triumphal entry of the king into Jerusalem. But this is an important prophetic event. It's an event that had been prophesied in the Old Testament, that the king would come riding on the foal of a colt into Jerusalem as the legitimate king on the exact date prophesied by Daniel, as the legitimate king of Israel. And now the nation gets a chance to say yea or nay to their legitimate king. And the people have already said no, pretty much, and the Pharisees have already made up their mind, but Jesus has nevertheless this small group of friends that are with him. And the response of Jesus over the city when he sees the city is to weep over it. There's a little church on the Mount of Olives called Dominus Flevit, the Lord wept. It's the shape of a teardrop. You can go there today. It commemorates the fact that Jesus paused over, looking down over the city of Jerusalem from the donkey and weeping in sorrow, knowing what lie ahead for the city. He said, if you had known, even you, especially in this your day, the things that make for your peace, if you had only known the importance of this significant event right now, what's happening before your very eyes, but now they are hidden from your eyes. The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment around you, surround you, and close you in on every side, and level you and your children within you to the ground, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not know the time of your visitation. How's that? You didn't realize the significance of this event, the whole city, and the consequences are the whole of Jerusalem is going to be leveled and in ruins. That's a part of the reason for the great sorrow that Jesus has at this time. Now that's Palm Sunday. Jesus went down to the temple. We don't know what else he did on that day. He came back and stayed overnight at the home of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And now the news is out that Jesus is in town. And so now we're going to get a very, very packed week with a whole bunch of things happening. And that's where we'll pick up in 2 weeks, God willing. All right? And again, I'd suggest, because so much is going on, that a good investment would be a Harmony of the Gospels. You can find it on the internet. I have the one here by Robert Thomas and Stanley Gundry, but they're easy to find. And that way we see everything going on.